couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films Land, Judas and the Black Messiah, Tentacles, Barb and Star Go to Vista Del Mar, and The Map of Tiny Perfect Things. I'm also going to be talking about some news and the trailer park, as well as the home cinema roundup featuring Freaky and Greenland. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/kevincarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Joss Whedon. This goes back to Ray Fisher complaining about his treatment on the Justice League by director Joss Whedon when Joss Whedon was brought in after Zack Snyder had to bow out. We've heard the Ray Fisher story, and it's somewhat vague, but it's caused an investigation in Warner Brothers. And just this week, Charisma Carpenter, who was on Angel and Buffy the Vampire Slayer, has made some accusations against Joss Whedon as well, saying she stands by Ray Fisher. In particular, she talks about how he was insulting to her, how he had they use the term toxic work environment, but that's very vague. I don't know exactly what it means. I don't know what the details are. She gives a couple things, like she talks about being fat shamed because she was pregnant and she was trying to officially let him know through her agent, but he was calling her fat, even though she was only 126 pounds is what she was saying. And other stars from the Buffy the Vampire Slayer days have come out and weighed in, like Sarah Michelle Gellar has come out, and she weighed in, but in a very vague way, because she, in her post, said something to the effect of saying, this is behind me, and I don't want it to dominate my life, but she's like, we all knew what was going on behind the scenes, whatever that means. And there's been other cast members who have offered support. And the reason I think this is such a big deal, there was always this image that everyone had a good time on it. Everyone loved working for him. And they always presented the Buffy the Vampire cast and crew as like a family. That helps perpetuate the good nature feeling of the show. But apparently it wasn't. And apparently Joss Whedon had whatever toxic environment and his attitudes were not always on the up and up, apparently. At least that's what people are saying, allegedly. But here's the thing. The sad case of the fact is that this happens all the time on movie sets. And I'm not defending Joss Whedon. I do not have a horse in this race at all. I'm not a big fan of Joss Whedon. I've never met the guy. I don't know him personally. And I've never watched the show Buffy the Vampire Slayer or Angel. I had no interest in those. I like the Avengers movies. But the reality is TV and filmmaking is incredibly high stress. And some of the greatest filmmakers and showrunners are not always the nicest people. I mean, look, even like historically, you look at figures like Alfred Hitchcock and Louis B. Mayer. These people were monsters to work for. They were really difficult to deal with, but they were very, very good at what they did. They just weren't very good at being a decent human being at times. There was a movie out in the 90s called Swimming with Sharks, and Kevin Spacey was in it, ironically. It was all about him as just the worst boss to work for in Hollywood. So this is nothing new. You throw in a bunch of emotional people, which are actors because they deal in emotion, and you throw in egos, and you throw in a lot of money, and you throw in a hot, high-stress environment. I mean, working on a movie set, I've worked on movie sets, and you're there early in the morning, you're there late at night, you're there 6 days a week, if not more. Depending on the situation, it is high stress, very exhausting. So you are going to get conflicts and problems, and you're dealing with millions or hundreds of millions of dollars. And sometimes the people that are the jerks get the job done, and that's unfortunate. But we have to get past this misconception that every movie is a wonderful time and that everybody, you know, you could only enjoy a film if they had a good time doing it. But that's just not the case. So I'm curious to see where this goes, because there's I don't think there's anything actionable on this. I think this is just an attempt to kind of get rid of Joss Whedon, or at least make him learn his lesson. I don't know if that's going to happen. Who knows? The next piece of news that's similar in terms of cancel culture that a lot of people are all worried about, and that's Gina Carano has been fired or let go from the Star Wars universe. Her character, Cara Dune, is either going to be recast or written out of The Mandalorian. And this is a result of her putting out some pretty incendiary tweets. This one made her look like an anti-Semitic monster. And this is not the first time that Gina Carano has stepped into a bear trap when it comes to social media. She's also lost her representation. And there are a lot of people saying, oh, cancel culture, isn't this terrible? Look, cancel culture has been around a lot longer than the term cancel culture is. I mean, there was this thing called McCarthyism that was the height of cancel culture in U.S. Hollywood productions. But there's other stuff like Jane Fonda. Talk about somebody who, there is a person I do radio with who will remain nameless, who literally threatened to walk out of the studio when I was getting ready to review a movie she just happened to be in. It was a completely legitimate film, but he so would not talk about Jane Fonda. He wanted to talk about cancel culture. I mean, that was what, 50 years ago? And then you got the whole story of Eartha Kitt speaking out against the Vietnam War to Johnson and Lady Bird and having that impact her career, or the Dixie Chicks. And one of the things with the Dixie Chicks, they just didn't know their audience. I mean, if the Indigo Girls had said what the Dixie Chicks said, it wouldn't have been a big deal. But sometimes cancel culture is appropriate. I mean, look at something like Bill Cosby. You know, it's kind of hard to watch a sitcom about him being a perfect dad when you know he's out there drugging and raping women. I imagine Disney has some sort of clause written in their contracts that says you need to watch what you say and do on social media. And you cannot become controversial. They probably don't say political. They probably say controversial. And what Carano retweeted was certainly controversial and horrible. And it was not the first time she did something like this. It's sort of like Roseanne when she got kicked off her show. It wasn't that Roseanne just came out of nowhere. It's just she tweeted something horribly racist, and that was the last straw. They were just waiting for something, for her to do something stupid, and then she did it, and they got her off the show. First of all, cancel culture has been around forever, and both sides of the political aisle engage in it repeatedly and still do. But it's also, sometimes it's you reap what you sow. It's more about your consequence, and you got to be careful what you say, especially if you're working for somebody like Disney, because Cara Dune can be recast or she can be killed. I mean, the story's about a galactic war, for crying out loud. This is not about the First Amendment. She can say whatever she wants to, but a large corporation that is putting millions or hundreds of millions of dollars into her work doesn't need to keep her on if she's going to be a problem. Listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. A couple Super Bowl spots that came out last week. One of them is Falcon and the Winter Soldier, which premieres on Disney Plus on March 19th.
Mr. Barnes, why does Sam aggravate you?
15 seconds to drop!
So what's our plan? Hey.
Great. Superheroes cannot be allowed to exist. I have no intention to leave my work unfinished.
Where do we start?
Oh, yeah?
This looks like it's fun. It looks like it's going to be loaded with action. I don't get a great sense of story because I still don't know how great the foil between Sebastian Stan and Anthony Mackie is going to be. I mean, they really never developed their relationship, so who knows? I mean, this looks like it's going to be a little more just straight up superhero action than something like WandaVision, but I'll still watch it come next month. The next one I want to hit is Old, which is in theaters on July 23rd.
Are we there yet?
This beach, it's beautiful.
My swimsuit is hurting.
They do look small.
Come on, let's play hide and seek.
Have you seen my children?
Mom, I'm right here.
He was 6 years old this morning.
Oh no.
Mom, I'm scared!
There's something wrong with this beach.
We were chosen for a reason.
What's happening?
I don't know.
I can't think.
Owned. Only in theaters this summer.
Look, I like M. Night Shyamalan's stuff. I think his stuff is clever and fun, and yeah, it's all just Twilight Zone stories, but I like that stuff. It speaks to me, and I enjoy watching it. I like his Twilight Zone-esque stories, and that's what Old looks like, so I'm really looking forward to this one. That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about land and tentacles. Black Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the movie reviews and hit the first big wide release. In fact, I think this is actually the only wide release that's in theaters this week. It's going everywhere, and it's called Land. It stars and is directed by Robin Wright, and it's, I believe, it's her directorial debut for a feature film. She, of course, directed several episodes of House of Cards, but this is the first movie that she's done. And in the film, a woman retreats from society to the Rocky Mountains after a personal tragedy.
How did you find me?
You were in my path.
You know, one might wonder how someone like you came to be in this place. I'm not running from anyone. I'm not hiding. I'm here because I choose to be.
If it's all right, I will teach you how to trap. And the fall to hunt. And then you won't see me anymore.
This is clearly an award bait movie. It's coming out in the early part of the year. It's aiming to be any and all award consideration. It's been pushed. It's been promoted. I've gotten a screener for it. I've gotten emails about it. It is one of those movies, and you get these every year. There's a slate of movies that are there to win some person an Academy Award. Now, sometimes it's just for acting, and it's directed by somebody else, but nobody cares about who directed it. They're trying to get the actor nominated for an Oscar. And this exists for no other reason than to get Robin Wright nominated either as an actor or as a director, because, of course, it's her directorial debut as a feature. Movies like this, there's a lot of them. There's a lot of the movies, not just movies that are meant to win somebody an award, but movies specifically like this about somebody who deals with something traumatic or tragic in their life, and then they essentially go to find themselves or they retreat. There was that movie with Emilia Hirsch, I was like about 10 years ago, called Into the Wild, where he went off into Alaska. It was based on a true story. There was that movie several years ago with Reese Witherspoon. I think it was called Wild, just called Wild, where she went on a trek on her own. And it was unlike anything else she's ever done. And what's interesting is Robin Wright's done a wide variety of stuff. If you actually go look at her filmography, she bounces all over the place. She started in soap operas and, of course, was in The Princess Bride, but she's been drama and she's done comedy. You know, she's ended up in big movies like Forrest Gump, which I don't think necessarily was a great movie because of her, but she was lucky enough to be in it. And then she was in like the Wonder Woman movies. And she was also in this movie several years ago called The Congress, which I thought was a really interesting movie that used her as an actual character, Robin Wright as a character she played herself. And that one was a little bit heady about this sort of like artificial cartoon land that they were able to psychedelically map onto somebody's brain. So she's been in some really interesting stuff and actually some somewhat artistic and heady stuff. The problem with Land is this is nothing more than an excuse for her to act. And she does a great job acting. She conveys the emotion. She lives the emotion. You see it in her face and her entire body acts through this. And she does a good job acting. And on certain levels, the directing elements are beautiful. I mean, it's gorgeously shot. I've always wondered with a movie like this that looks as good as it is, how much hand-holding goes on in the process, because I don't know how much it was her being the auteur or just setting the stage for wanting to act and sort of like having the DP take over with the look of the film or having the editor take over putting it together. But like any sort of directorial debut that you're going to see, like with Viggo Mortensen and Falling from last week I talked about, there's some scenes and shots and elements that are like overly on the nose that you're like, you could have been a little more subtle if you had a little more experience as a director. But my biggest problem with this movie is it's just boring. There's nothing more than an excuse for her to act. Yes, she does a fine job acting in it, but there's nothing more to it. Even the idea of whatever this tragic event that happened that she never really directly addresses throughout most of the film, you can guess what it is. It's not a big surprise when you're finally go, oh, this is what happened. I kind of figured that that's what it was, because they deal with flashbacks and elements and stuff. And you're like, well, it's one of two or three things. And it ended up being one of those two or three things. So it just doesn't have that emotional impact when you know you're being set up for it. I mean, it's very manipulated. It's not one of those things where sometimes you see a movie where it's manipulative in terms of the emotional elements to it. But you're just like, I'm happy to be manipulated because I'm in it. I'm invested for that ride. This one, it's like being forced to look at a really, really nice painting and then tell somebody how awesome that painting was. Even though you're like, well, I mean, the painting was nice, but you know, there's hundreds of these out there. So I'm going to have to say that Land just didn't quite do it for me. So I'm going to say it kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next movie I want to talk about is Tentacles. Part of Hulu's Into the Dark series, this Valentine's Day episode tells the story of a homeless woman who falls in love with a new landlord, only for him to discover she has a dangerous past.
You're engaged? This is crazy fast.
Nation.
I don't want to ruin this.
I want to be connected to you forever.
Something around you is making you sick.
Tell me what's really going on. Who are you?
I don't know.
This is, as I said in the description, a part of the Hulu Into the Dark series, which is a episodic movie of the month, I guess you could say, set up in Hulu, and they're all horror movie elements. And I covered a couple of these last year because they stopped making, I think it was around 4th of July. They did one which was called The Current Occupant, when it was a horror movie about a president who has been deposed and appears to be in an insane asylum. This one is ostensibly a love story, and it's meant to be this bizarre love story, something along the lines of Spring, if you ever saw that film. It's a smaller budgeted film. It's a smaller, more contained movie. I mean, most of the focus on this film is of this mysterious woman and her new boyfriend and a couple people he knows. So there aren't any big scenes. There aren't any large crowd scenes. It's Blumhouse who is putting this together, and Blumhouse has a knack for doing those very low budget horror movies that are based on conceptual ideas. And it's interesting. It's got some cool stuff in it. It dances on the edge of body horror at certain points. So it is kind of drawing from a Cronenberg perspective. The problem is that it takes a little bit too long to kind of get there. Kind of like when I was talking about Land, where Land, you were expecting Land to do something different, but it just went down a familiar path. This one, you kind of can guess what's going on, but it takes a long time for the movie to actually kind of confirm what you're thinking, because kind of what you're thinking is a little bit out there and weird, but it's a horror movie. And so it has some grisly moments. It has some intense moments. Overall, the acting's okay. The characters aren't great. You sort of are presented with them and said, oh, well, they're attractive people and you have to like them, even if you don't know them very well as characters. They're kind of underdeveloped. But, you know, still for a throwaway horror movie, it's not bad, especially if you're looking for something as an alternative to Valentine's Day. So I'm going to have to say the Tentacles kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Judas and the Black Messiah and Barb and Star Go to Vista Del Mar. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews and talk about Judas and the Black Messiah. This biopic looks at the FBI's investigation of Black Panther leader Fred Hampton.
18 months for the stolen car. 5 years for impersonating a federal officer. Or you can go home.
The Black Panthers are forming a rainbow coalition of oppressed brothers and sisters of every color.
Their aim is to sow hatred and inspire terror.
I will learn all that I can. I will
learn. These ain't no terrorists.
You can murder a liberator, but you can't murder liberation.
This is released by Warner Brothers, and I believe it is like a lot of the other Warner Brothers movies right now. It's going to be going to HBO Max as well as in theaters. So you don't have to see it in the theaters. You can choose to see it online, but of course you got to have a subscription. And this is dropped right in the middle of Black History Month, and it makes sense because it is about Black history. And the movie is a great pairing with that documentary I talked about a couple weeks ago called MLK FBI. Even though Martin Luther King Jr. was in no way involved with the Black Panthers, and the Black Panthers had a very different ideological bent to it, it deals with the investigation that the FBI had into a Black organization, especially back then, you know, back in the 60s and 70s. You think about FBI investigations today, and they're kind of different. I mean, yeah, there's a lot of investigations that the FBI is doing right now that we have no idea what they're doing. They don't make it public that they're investigating certain things. Back then, you know, this was during the civil rights, and they were worried about terrorism. And in particular, the Black Panthers were a lot more aggressive than, say, MLK. And in particular, it's about Fred Hampton, who was like only like, he was in his early 20s. I mean, he was like 20 when this was going on. And he was becoming a very powerful leader in the Black Panther movement. And the Black Panther movement was aggressive, in your face, unapologetic, and potentially violent because they did have guns. Very similar to back in the 90s when they were starting to investigate some of these militia movements, especially in the wake of the Oklahoma City bombing. And in particular, this is told from the point of view of a guy who was brought in as a criminal informant and infiltrated the Black Panthers and then gave information to the FBI about it. And what's interesting is I do not know the history of this. I'll admit that right up. I was too young when this happened to understand it on the news, and it was something that was very controversial at the time, and the events that play out in the film, when they happened, were given a much different public story than they are revealed to be now. And after an investigation and a look back at that, the prevailing wisdom and the overall idea of what probably happened has changed over the years. Even though Fred Hampton maybe had some gnarly things in his past, what happens to him and what happens to his organization probably shouldn't have happened and was arguably not legal. With all the hubbub that people are making about movements like a Black Lives Matter movement now, and you compare certain elements to the Black Panther movement, and some there's certain similarities, sure, and there's certain differences. And it's interesting when you see what is agitating people who are bothered by those movements in both eras. Now, the movie itself, it's well done with great acting and some really sharp, clever directing elements to it. The problem with it for me is it seems very disjointed and uneven in terms of a narrative story. And that's probably because it's based on a true story. And I've always said that life has a great sense of drama, but not always a great sense of timing, which is why in so many biopics and historical dramas, there's liberties taken with the historical fiction. And I feel that they almost didn't do that in this movie for certain elements to it and just sort of let it play out in the somewhat unevenly paced way it does because it's a little closer to what happened. And that doesn't take anything away from the movie. It's just, it's a little bit hard to concentrate, especially if you do not know any of the history and you're still trying to figure out who's who and how they fall into either what you've heard or what you don't even know. But overall, I mean, Judas and the Black Messiah is worth seeing, especially if it bothers you. That's the best kind of person to see this movie. If this movie bothers you and the content of it bothers you, good. You should be challenging yourself in terms of what your beliefs are just to make sure that they work, because that's how you know you've got strong beliefs and you shouldn't just dismiss certain things just because they don't fit your worldview. It's worth seeing something to be offered a different perspective. And this movie certainly gives that to you, especially if you're part of, you know, like me, who's part of white America. So I'm going to have to say that Judas and the Black Messiah kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Barb and Star Go to Vista Del Mar. Two middle-aged Midwestern women take a trip to Florida only to get caught up in a spy mission.
Hey, Barb. Yes, Star. You know what I just love?
What?
Movie trailers.
Me too.
I like how they're little movies about another movie before a different movie.
Sometimes I find myself watching a trailer for a movie while I'm watching a totally different movie.
What? Me too. Barb, what if we had a movie?
What? Then we'd have to have a trailer.
Oh, yes, listen, I wouldn't want to give anything away, though, about the movie.
Me neither, especially our faces.
Gosh, I can almost see our trailer now.
This is easily one of the weirdest movies I've seen in a while. And I've seen some weird movies. I've certainly seen some weird movies when you talk about science fiction films and horror films. This movie is bizarre because while it's unabashedly a comedy, it is sometimes hard to explain what it is. It is a trail of absurdities that clearly make the creators of this laugh, which the creators are, of course, Kristen Wiig, who stars in it, Andy Mamolo, who was one of the writers for Bridesmaids, and even behind the scenes, you've got Will Ferrell and his company working on it. And this movie is clearly very funny to them. It's like a Saturday Night Live sketch that not everybody's going to get. It's something that some people are going to find hilarious and knee slapping and fall on the floor laughing till your side hurts. And it's going to get a completely WTF response from another segment of the audience. It's very funny to just watch these two interact and how they have this quirky conversation and this tone and this cadence. And if you actually really listen to what they say sometimes is so bizarre and absurd, and they just blast past it. That's the other thing this movie does, which is brilliant comedy. It does not wink and nod to the audience. It's like there was that whole series of spoof movies that were done by the Seltzer and Friedberg guys, you know, like Epic Movie and Disaster Movie, and they'd make a joke and then they'd look at the audience and wink and nod and then explain the joke. And I'm like, that's not how comedy works. Comedy, you throw the joke out there and you move on. So by the time you've gotten that first joke, you've blown past two more jokes. That's what makes good comedy. And that's what they do here with the two women having their conversations. They're not making like punchline jokes. They're just saying absurd and crazy things. And then they move on and you barely have time to react to it to go to the next one. The other thing is, it goes completely outside of its genre. You know, we've had genre-bending things where you had somebody who's a normal person get caught up in a spy game. But this, I mean, starts out as basically a Bond villain, who's also played by Kristen Wiig, who's developing this weapon that's going to wipe out this little city called Vista Del Mar. And it's about these two women who end up going down there and they run into the spy who's trying to do this. And they get caught up with him. He's played by Jamie Dornan. And his character is actually very funny too. And it warps into like these musical numbers, but it's not a musical. I mean, it is so strange, but it's right on point and it's extremely funny if you get it. And I imagine there's going to be people who are going to watch this movie and they're going to roll their eyes and be like, I don't understand this. And that's okay. The wonderful thing about comedy is it's very personal. And there are some comedies that people think are hilarious that nobody else does. And there are some comedies that don't translate, and that's okay. But I found this movie to be breezy, fun, bright, and vibrant. And it's the kind of movie that's fun to watch. I mean, it was meant to go into the theaters, but it's fun to watch as we're still sort of dealing with a pandemic and we're in the middle of winter. It's just neat to watch something that's bright and colorful and silly. And if there's any word that would go with this, that word is fun. And I had a blast. So I'm going to say Barb and Star Go to Vista Del Mar totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about the map of Tiny Perfect Things and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring Freaky and Greenland. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on and get the final movie review out there. There's actually a ton of movies that have come out this week. There's a couple movies that are out this week I didn't even have time for in the show. Stuff like Willy's Wonderland or French Exit or The Martarian. I'm just going to move those to next week. It's been an amazingly huge amount of movies coming out, not just in theaters, but on video on demand like Barb and Star, and movies going direct to streaming services like this one, The Map of Tiny Perfect Things, going to Amazon, and Tentacles going to Hulu. So let's just jump into this. In The Map of Tiny Perfect Things, this Amazon Prime original features a teenager caught in a time loop when he discovers another girl in town who's also reliving the day over and over.
This is gonna sound really strange. I was wondering, are you experiencing any kind of temporal anomaly?
Listen, we're stuck in a time loop. You, me, everybody, same days repeating over and over again. Like in Groundhog Day and Edge of Tomorrow. Except only me and this girl Margaret know about it. And you don't remember any of this because your brain keeps getting erased.
Oh.
So, what have you been up to with infinite time?
Oh, you know, like solving crimes and teaching myself how to drive.
So you're into her?
Well, like I'm not into her.
Obviously, this is the same type of story as Groundhog Day or Edge of Tomorrow. Those are the two most famous movies. There's a bunch of other time loop stories out there. Well, and most recently you had Palm Springs. I honestly think, let me just point this out. The movie Palm Springs that was on Hulu earlier last year, the fact that that came out so close to this one, I think is going to harm it because that one's a romantic comedy, as is this one. Only this one's a little more of a sweeter romantic comedy. Palm Springs was a little more raunchy and R-rated. This one's clearly that PG-13 crowd aiming for the high school audience. So in the map of Tiny Perfect Things, it opens up with a kid clearly in the middle of this time loop. And he has been through it a dozen or hundreds of times, and he's just reliving the day. And that's when, after a couple times going through the loop, he discovers this girl as well. And the two of them start to get to know each other. And it then just becomes them having this cute little romance and of course, dealing with the time loop as it is, but re-meeting up and getting to know each other. And ultimately, their plan is to get the perfect set of tiny little things that are adorable and wonderful in town. And overall, it's a cute little romantic comedy for sort of that teenage, early 20-something crowd without being edgy and not loaded with sex and drinking and violence or anything like that, which Palm Springs was. And it works to that extent, but it's very much that sweet romance. My big problem with it was it treated the relationship with the girl as the trophy. At the end, it finally redeems itself and tries to make her more significant, but ultimately it kind of plays itself off as she's his to win, which is not great, but I mean, at least it's not violating some of the stuff that they did in the 80s, like with 16 Candles and Revenge of the Nerds or anything like that. But overall, it's a sweet little romance that has a nice, charming conclusion. So it's a harmless movie and a nice little way to spend 90 minutes, especially if you're looking for a romance this weekend. So I'm going to have to say the map of Tiny Perfect Things kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. This week's spotlight is going to be on Greenland. Gerard Butler stars as a father trying to get his estranged wife and child to safety when a comet cluster threatens to wipe out life on Earth.
We now are getting word that the fragment has hit Central Florida.
Oh my God.
Wait, are some more pieces gonna hit?
Come on, let's go.
But the sky's on fire.
2 days. They got it all wrong. There's a ton of fragments. Planet killers.
Space agencies are predicting an extinction-level event.
We're gonna get together, all right, kiddo?
We're just trying to get to safety.
They've been tracking the military flights to bunkers in Greenland.
It's their only chance.
Move back! I remember when this was being advertised. It was originally supposed to come out in theaters in America, and it ended up being just pivoted straight to PVOD, which I think it appeared on PVOD, I think, sometime in December. So a lot of people have already seen it, and I had a conversation with a guy online who I think he's from Sweden, and he said he saw it in the theaters. Now, this would have been a great movie to see in the theaters because it's a bona fide disaster flick. In the spirit of the modern disaster flick that was sort of re-pioneered by Roland Emmerich, you see a lot of connective tissue between this and stuff like 2012, or even if you go back more than 20 years to Deep Impact in particular, much more Deep Impact than Armageddon. And it's the story of these people trying to survive this cataclysm. And the thing I liked the most about it was the fact that it dealt with certain real things that are unpleasant. It dealt with the fact that in a situation like this, if they're going to try and save certain people, you can't save everybody. And there's going to be blowback from that. They have a couple nods to some old Twilight Zone episodes, one in particular about saving your own family rather than the family down the street. There's also a reality about what people do in these extreme situations and how some people will rise to the occasion and become martyrs. And we've saw this in the pandemic, that there were some people that went above and beyond and put themselves in danger to help other people. And they were saints and heroes. And then there are people who bent the rules and manipulated facts and are constantly trying to protect themselves and nobody else, oftentimes taking away protection from somebody else to further enrich themselves. And that's a lot of reality. The entire second act of this movie is nothing but showing how horrible people are to each other in a situation of this potential terror. And there's some science in here that's real wonky. I was complaining about it on Twitter when I was watching it, and somebody called me Neil deGrasse Tyson, which I took as a compliment. he's not nearly as good looking as I am, though. But, I mean, it's a good bona fide disaster movie. You know, something like, you know, remember San Andreas, the one with The Rock and him trying to save his family from giant tidal waves and stuff like that? But, you know, overall, I really enjoyed it. I was surprised at how much I enjoyed Greenland. So I'm going to have to say it's totally worth checking out, either for rental or getting the disc on Blu-ray. It totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Freaky. It's now available on DVD and Blu-ray. Vince Vaughn plays a serial killer who accidentally swaps bodies with a high school girl.
Honestly, if this was a horror movie, I'd be one of the first ones to get killed.
Cue the creepy dude in the mask.
But actually, it turns out...
Where am I?
I didn't get killed.
Oh my God, why do I sound like that?
I woke up in the killer's body.
The Blissfield Butcher strikes again.
It's a slaughterhouse.
I have like less than 6 hours to swap back, or I'm going to be stuck in his body forever.
Kind of like how you had the time loop movies. This is the body swap movie. It falls right into that category. But the thing that's interesting about this is it puts it within the context of a slasher movie. And this has been directed by Christopher Landon, who's best known for doing Happy Death Day and Happy Death Day to You, which mixed the slasher genre with, you guessed it, a time loop story. So he's kind of making a little bit of a name for himself, merging a pre-existing genre with the slasher films. And that's a lot of fun. And the reason it works is because this one lends itself to comedy, because body swap movies are almost always a comedy. Of course, because you got Vince Vaughn, who's this towering Hulk, and this girl who's in high school, and she's, you know, 5'5" at most when she's, and, you know, maybe when her hair's done up. So it's neat to see the comedy you can mine from that, but they shoot it as a slasher movie. They don't shoot it as a comedy. You know, I said Barb and Star was very much a comedy that bends its genre. This is very much a slasher movie that lends itself to comedy. So it's not winking and nodding at the audience. It's just presenting some scenes that are somewhat laughable at times. And Freaky excels at deconstructing the slasher genre while at the same time being a bona fide slasher movie, kind of the way Scream did back in the 90s. The other thing it does that propels it beyond the Happy Death Day movies is it's not rated PG-13. It goes for the gore. It goes for the blood and the slasher elements, and that's part of what makes a slasher movie authentic. And if you don't have that, you don't really have an authentic slasher movie. And that's why I think this one feels more like a slasher movie than Happy Death Day. But I gotta say, it's a lot of fun. There's some obvious jokes in there, but overall, I mean, it's a hoot to watch. And I would love to see at some point Christopher Landon mix the two series together. And people have already talked about, you know, having Freaky Death Day, you know, bring up these two characters, have a body swap and a time loop movie. That would be a lot of fun. So I have to say, I enjoyed the heck out of Freaky. I'd seen it already during its initial release, and it was great to revisit. Has some neat stuff. It was kind of like Greenland. Had some neat stuff in the bonus features, but that's not the reason to get it. The reason to get it is for the movie itself, which is completely entertaining. So I'm going to say that Freaky totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
Also available this week include Sputnik, Elysium in 4K, Sky Sharks, whatever that is, The Parallax View, the Criterion Collection, and Tourist Trap, a collector's version of that film. And that's it. Next week, I'm going to be talking about Minari, French Exit, and The Mauritarian. Until then, have a fat time at the movies or at home.